From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Isabel Allende has captivated the world with her writing.
My mind works like the mind of a storyteller. I want the highlights, the lowlights. I want the tension, the rhythm, the tragic. That's what interests me. But lives are not like that.
This hour, I talk with the New York Times best-selling author. She has a new book out and is speaking tonight in Atlanta. First, though, I recently spoke to another cultural icon, bassist Mike Mills of REM. He reflected on the 25th anniversary of the group's signature album, Automatic for the People.
Every record is a time capsule. Every record is an encapsulation of what the band was and what they were thinking and what they were feeling at that moment, which is why they're so cool, because they're pretty much self-contained.
Many of you shared your favorite REM songs. Here are your first thoughts. Jordan Stepp of Athens says she loves the song Ignoreland off the Automatic for the People album.
It's a pulsing, political, angry screed about the injustices of the Reagan and first Bush years. And originally, it was specifically about that time period. And you would hope that it would have never have come back around to relevance again. But eventually, the band did dust it off for the George W. Bush years as well.
And we'd love to know what you think. Do you have a favorite song? Call us at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. U.S. Senate candidate Roy Moore has been accused of sexual misconduct by five women. You may know Moore as the so-called Ten Commandments judge. He earned that nickname for refusing to move a monument of the Ten Commandments from the Alabama Judicial Building. A story alleges Moore molested teenage girls when he was in his 30s, and it broke in the Washington Post last week. Many high-ranking Republicans have called on him to drop out of the race. But one state poll says Moore enjoys support by many of Alabama evangelicals, and that could be part of a bigger picture. In 2011, the Public Religion Research Institute found only 30% of white evangelicals thought elected officials who commit an immoral act could still fulfill their public duties. In 2016, that number had more than doubled to 72%. Dan Cox is director of research for PRRI. Hi there, Dan.
Hi, great to be here.
How do we know this is a real trend, and this isn't just about the support for Donald Trump that many have already noted among evangelicals?
Well, every race is unique. Moore's situation is definitely unique, and we won't really know anything until all the votes are counted. In fact, I'm actually seeing within the last hour now that some of the political prognosticators are downgrading Moore's chances now, and that gives some sense that, you know, Alabama voters do view these allegations as serious. So we'll see where what evangelical Protestants end up, but I do think that it's having an effect on all voters down there.
Well, then can we go back in history just a little bit to the beginnings of the evangelical involvement in politics, and kind of have you explained how far we have come from the days of the moral majority, when the purpose of getting involved, as I understood it, among many evangelicals, was to bring more Christian values into politics? Was that not one of the goals?
Absolutely. And evangelical leaders made, you know, personal moral comportment a cornerstone of what they were looking for in a particular candidate. It was sort of the bedrock of how they would view a potential candidate, and everything else followed from there. At least that was the rhetoric. Now it so happened that those politicians ended up being, you know, predominantly Republican. And so I think that has really played an important role when you think of, you know, the last three Republican presidential candidates, John McCain, Mitt Romney, and Donald Trump. There's very few things to tie them all together in terms of their style, where they were in issues. The one sort of defining feature that they all shared was that they were Republican, and they all garnered extensive support among white evangelical Protestant voters. So I think that, you know, we sort of moved on from a place where, you know, candidates are viewed as, you know, more individuals, and our politics has become a lot more tribal. Political identities are no longer just markers of policy differences. They're increasingly aligning with religious, racial, ethnic, and cultural differences as well.
Well, we asked some people in Atlanta the same questions. They are not evangelicals. We asked them the same question that your PRRI survey asked. If an elected official commits an immoral act in their personal life, can they still behave ethically and fulfill their duties in their public and professional life? So here's a few answers.
I think your personal life is completely separate from your professional life. Within this country, you are innocent until proven guilty in a court of law.
My name is Mary Jo Peed. Certainly is something that is important, because once you have an ethical breach in any part of your life, it's like everything else, you know. Oh, it's maybe easier the second time around.
My name is Morgan Ott. I'm from Atlanta, Georgia. No, I think there's a crossover between your personal life and your professional life that you can't, like, escape.
It's a continuum, right? Your behavior.
So, Dan, it kind of seems like that a little bit reflects what you guys found, because the average American does seem to believe there is crossover between what you do in your personal life and what you do in politics.
Mm-hmm. And you know, this was a debate, and many conservatives, I think, like to remind liberals now that, you know, this was a central debate during the Clinton era, when he faced a situation where, you know, he was there were allegations of him, you know, being inappropriate with an intern, Monica Lewinsky. And so I think, you know, both sides have had to wrestle with this issue. It's also been, you know, an important issue in many local races as well. And so I think, you know, it's not exclusive to white evangelicals to sort of face an issue where their particular candidate who they support. And I think it's important to remember that Moore has been a longstanding, you know, proponent of many issues that are really important, particularly symbolic issues of sort of safeguarding Christian expression in the public realm. And so I think in this case, like, there's so much that history there that I think it's sort of tough to give that up, even when you hear such, you know, incredibly damaging allegations.
And yet a number of prominent evangelicals even have express some serious concerns about Moore's candidacy, and even more about the support, the continued support of Alabama voters for Moore. Here's Ed Stetzer, the executive director of the Billy Graham Center for Evangelism, and he's speaking to NPR.
A lot of people are wondering, what do these crazy Christians believe? And that just fed into a narrative that gee whiz, sometimes you just got to say, this is not what we believe.
And that leads me back to my, you know, similar question I asked earlier, which is, are we just looking at a moment in time? In other words, is this sort of reaction a reaction to the discussion over Roy Moore?
Yeah, well, I do think it's helpful to step back, right, when you think about where, you know, particularly conservative Christians are coming from. And I think it's always helpful to sort of paint with a broader brush in terms of the context in which we're operating. The moral climate has changed dramatically over the last 15 to 20 years. When you look at how people view sex between adults of the same gender, and whether that's morally acceptable, whether how people view whether it's okay to have a baby outside of marriage, divorce, and even things like, you know, marijuana. You know, we've come to a place where, you know, conservative Christians were had a mainstream opinions on most of those issues, where, you know, it was not more acceptable, to a place where now a lot of that is morally acceptable. And so I think that's engendering a lot of insecurity among conservative Christians about, you know, where the country's headed, and fear that it's going to a place where, you know, they don't recognize the country anymore. And so I think when there's that kind of feeling of trepidation, it's, I think, sometimes easier to make the kind of decisions where, well, you know, we're on the sinking ship, and we have a captain that can get us to land. You know, let's just have that captain, regardless of his faults, you know, see if he can get us there.
Or the lesser of two evils, right? Let's hear this comment from another Alabama resident. This is Ronald Lepke.
Until this is fully investigated, I do not believe that people should make any decisions about Judge Roy Moore, period, particularly because if he's not elected to the Senate, what you're looking at is a Democrat in the Senate.
Which takes us back to your earlier comment that we've become more tribal. And you said we, and you weren't speaking, I think, just of evangelicals, were you?
No, this is true of everyone. And I think what happens that in those instances is when your particular member of your tribe is being attacked by someone outside, it creates sort of a rallying round effect. So it can actually be helpful. And I think for many evangelicals in Alabama, the Washington Post is not part of their tribe.
And neither is the Democrat who's running against Roy Moore.
Right.
But in that case, what does that tell us about trends in religion? Does that have a does what's happening right now over the not just the Senate race, but this is true of other cases and well in which as well, including the President Donald Trump, in which evangelicals have voiced a willingness to let go of certain beliefs in order to support him. He is a man who has three wives and he was not faithful to two of them. Are we seeing sort of a shift in the religious beliefs of evangelicals because of politics?
I don't really think so. I think the more sort of, if you're an evangelical, the more troubling situation is not this particular race, but where are particularly white evangelical Protestants heading? I've spent some time thinking about this, and I probably will be writing about it sometime in the near future. This question where, you know, whether white evangelical Protestants are heading to a cultural cul-de-sac, where they're getting older, they're shrinking, and a lot of what's going on is young people are leaving because they have different values on a lot of these issues, whether it's same-sex marriage, whether it's views about sexual morality more broadly, where their issues just don't align. And it's difficult to see, you know, because young people on a lot of those issues are probably not going to be changing their minds anytime soon. How do white evangelical Protestant churches and denominations reach out to this generation and become viable in a way that sort of helps them, you know, maintain their numbers and also maintains their cultural relevance? At a time when we are seeing such dramatic shifts going on.
We only have about 30 seconds left or so, Dan, but is there concern among evangelicals about how the reaction may be among young people who were already leaving the church?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that's always helpful to remind ourselves, you know, particularly those of us who follow these kind of things closely, is that I'm sure there's probably 80 to 85% of the country who doesn't know who Roy Moore is.
Yeah.
We obsess about these things, and they're important for a short period of time, but particularly if he loses, no one's going to remember how many white evangelical Protestants supported him. Mm. So I think the larger concern among the community is that you know, how do they engage a public, yeah, and particularly a young public, who is, you know, very rapidly shifting away from them on a lot of these issues.
Already, yeah. Dan Cox is Director of Research for the Public Religion Research Institute. Thank you so much, Dan.
It's my pleasure.
Just ahead, author Isabel Allende on Writing from the Heart. First, though, Atlanta takes a step toward protecting immigrants in the U.S. who are in the U.S. illegally. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. It's On Second Thought. Atlanta is one of about a dozen communities across the U.S. that's agreed to provide free legal representation to immigrants who face deportation. This initiative is called the Safe Cities Network, and it's part of the Vera Institute of Justice. It's the latest move to respond to heightened immigration restrictions coming from the Trump administration. The administration recently announced plans to end the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, or DACA. That program grants legal protections to people who entered the U.S. illegally as children. The president's decision leaves roughly 800,000 people who rely on that program in a kind of legal limbo. People like Valentina Emilia Garcia Gonzalez. We spoke with Gonzalez, who moved to Georgia after growing up in Uruguay. She now attends Dartmouth College in New Hampshire.
I think what a lot of people don't understand is that the concept of legality and illegality when it comes to immigration is already set up rules And so a lot of the time it comes down to privilege, right? In my country, we didn't have the privilege of even knowing how to come here legally and the legal ways of doing that. We were just very desperate to get out of a country. And my parents were very desperate to make sure that my brother and I were set up for success and for prosperity. So, you know, now I hear a lot of pushback and talking about like, well, you should have done it right. Your parents should have done it right. You know, it's a lot of talk about like, well, what is right? And if there is a way to do it legally, then why aren't there more legal immigrants, quote unquote, legal immigrants? And, you know, it comes back to the get in the line myth or get in the line excuse that people use. And there is no line. There is no concrete, easy, fast, legal way to become a citizen or a resident here.
But you have been here basically since you were in first grade. Do you consider yourself American?
Well, yes. I mean, besides being, you know, being born in a South American country, and that already grants me Americanness, you know, yes, I do consider myself American because I've fully assimilated into this country. I know more about this country, its history, its people, its culture, everything more so than Uruguay. You know, I like to think that Uruguay was like my birth country or like my birth mother that gave me up for adoption, and the United States took me with open arms and has given me everything.
So what changed for you? How different was it after Obama signed DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, as opposed to before?
I think that once DACA came about and I became a DACA recipient, the world opened up to me, right? It was very apparent to me, especially being in high school and seeing all my peers and all of my friends, being able to drive and do, I guess, the regular teen things, going out at night, doing, you know, driving. And then when it came to my senior year, applying to college, and I had to have a really rough conversation with my mother about being undocumented and what that meant for me. And that meant, you know, not being able to drive, not really going outside during certain times to not be caught by the police, changing my whole life and my whole life routine around just to avoid being seen and being known as an undocumented person. So once DACA did come about and Obama did sign that, I was able to work. I was able to help my parents and my family economically. I was able to get a license. But the thing is with DACA, as you know, thankful and as privileged as I am to be an undocumented person with DACA, what people don't understand is DACA is a very exploitative thing. The only thing that it grants me is a license and a work permit. It doesn't necessarily grant me a higher education, as is seen in Georgia, where undocumented students are banned from the top three universities now, where it used to be the top five, because of the Board of Regents Policy 416, and we are barred from financial aid because of Policy 434.
And DACA is expensive, too. You pay money to be part of that program. How much do you pay?
They just augmented it this past year or this year. I think we pay around $500 to $600 to file that. And plus, if we use an attorney to do that for us, it might be even more, like up to $1,000, $1,500.
So now that DACA has been or will be basically rescinded, what are you worried about?
Being at Dartmouth, I'm worried about my literal safety. And this is because I've had individual students and student organizations threaten to deport me. So that's a very big thing for me.
Your fellow students say they're going to have you deported?
So my freshman year, there was an incident where I got a message from an individual student that likened or kind of insinuated that if I ran for a student government position, that he could very easily call immigration. And then last year, after Trump got elected, a student organization on campus said that they could call ICE and have all the undocumented students deported at Dartmouth. And, you know, people didn't understand that that is a direct threat to our lives. And it was just very hard.
I can't imagine if you were deported back to Uruguay, what would you do? You were six when you left there.
Right. I think being my 15 years being in the United States, I've thought about it a lot. Going back, I've had dreams about it too, countless dreams about going back. But the thing is, I don't know anyone. I don't know anything. I've grown up in this country with just my parents and my siblings. You know, I have seen my friends go to their cousin's house, their grandparents' house, and my grandparents died while I have been in this country. I don't know where they're buried. I wasn't there for them when they died. You know, if I were to go back to Uruguay, my whole family, the six of us, we'd be living in a shed with an outhouse with maybe electricity. My family and I have talked about this a lot. We don't have anywhere to go. And to liken that to where we live now, where we live in a house, where we have, you know, a dog, we have food in our fridge, we have all these privileges, and to go back to a country that I literally know nothing about would be just devastating.
That's Valentina Emilia Garcia Gonzalez. She's one of roughly 800,000 people who rely on the federal DACA program. President Trump plans to get rid of that program. Elsewhere across the country, we've seen some colleges and universities define themselves as sanctuary campuses for students who are undocumented. This year, Governor Nathan Deal signed a measure into law that strips state funding for those colleges that declare themselves sanctuary campuses. Before that bill was approved by lawmakers, I talked about sanctuary campuses with Alyssa Steglish. She's a professor at the University of Texas School of Law's Immigration Clinic. And I asked her if the term sanctuary has a legal definition.
It does not. And some of the challenge with the dialogue right now concerning cities, counties, states, and campuses that have been associated with sanctuary policies is that there's no specific specificity to what those policies are. There's no shared consensus as to what sanctuary means. The sanctuary movement harkens back to a time in the 80s when it was largely faith-based. Houses of worship were standing as an act of civil disobedience against U.S. government policies at that time targeting refugees coming from Central America, where the U.S. had taken a certain position on the civil wars that was prompting migration to the United States. But the policies that are considered now don't seem to be in the same vein of taking an act of civil disobedience.
Right.
They're not going that far.
Let's hear from the president of Agnes Scott College. This is Elizabeth Keish, who says that they're considering becoming, I don't know if she's ready to put sanctuary as a label, but considering welcoming undocumented immigrants.
I believe it is a moral issue that, you know, young people who've done nothing wrong, these kids have done nothing wrong. You know, if an adult is caught speeding and their child is in the car, the child is not a criminal.
So I wanted to then play one more comment from her, and this is when we asked her if Agnes Scott College would become a sanctuary campus.
You know, I'm not quite sure what that label means. So, and also, I guess, you know, nothing has happened yet. The new federal administration has not made a decision on DACA, et cetera. And so to rush to take on a label, I don't believe is necessarily the right first step.
So DACA is Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. And she's saying that any decision she makes would be in reaction to something changing. What is the law now, and how are people afraid it might change?
Right. So there are a couple of things. One is that it's actually policy of the Federal Department of Homeland Security that enforces the U.S. immigration laws to have regard for colleges and other places of education as sensitive locations. So right now, the policy is, the norm is, ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, will not go onto campuses to engage in enforcement action. There is no law that says we cannot educate undocumented students. In fact, the Supreme Court in Filer v. Doe said precisely the opposite, that immigration status is not a proper inquiry when providing public education. So that's very clear. That these schools are not in current violation of any law, And none of the petitioned requests that have been going to Emory or other schools ask the universities to violate any law. So, again, if the federal government or state governments take the position that they want to withhold funding to these campuses, they're going to find themselves on difficult constitutional ground as well. In other areas where the federal government has not liked something that states have done and threatened to withhold federal funding, the Supreme Court again has said there has to be a very close tie, close relationship between that funding and the thing that the federal government has complaint with. So, you know, the larger research dollars, I don't think they have any relevance if the concern is whether the federal immigration and agencies will have cooperation in a law enforcement activity.
So, but it sounds, we have about a minute left, and I want to be totally clear on one thing, which is that what you're saying is that even through Supreme Court precedent, a university accepting and educating an undocumented student is not breaking the law?
Correct.
That's Alyssa Steglish. She's a law professor at the University of Texas at Austin. She teaches in the school's immigration clinic. Chilean-American novelist Isabel Allende has written a lot about the immigrant experience. Allende is a former journalist who fled Chile after the 1973 assassination of her uncle, who was that country's president. She's in Atlanta tonight to promote her latest book, In the Midst of Winter. Just ahead, I speak with her. First, I want to take a moment to hear something she wrote. In 2005, Isabel Allende agreed to write a deeply personal essay for NPR's series, This I Believe.
I have lived with passion and in a hurry, trying to accomplish too many things. I never had time to think about my beliefs until my 28-year-old daughter, Paula, fell ill. She was in a coma for a year, and I took care of her at home until she died in my arms in December of 1992. During that year of agony and the following year of my grieving, everything stopped for me. There was nothing to do, just cry and remember. However, that year also gave me an opportunity to reflect upon my journey and the principles that hold me together. I discovered that there is consistency in my beliefs, my writing, and the way I lead my life. I have not changed. I'm still the same girl I was 50 years ago, and the same young woman I was in the 70s. I still lust for life. I'm still ferociously independent. I still crave justice, and I fall madly in love easily. Paralyzed and silent in her bed, my daughter Paula taught me a lesson that is now my mantra. You only have what you give. It is by spending yourself that you become rich. Paula led a life of service. She worked as a volunteer, helping women and children, 8 hours a day, 6 days a week. She never had any money, but she needed very little. When she died, she had nothing, and she needed nothing. During her illness, I had to let go of everything: her laughter, her voice, her grace, her beauty, her company, and finally, her spirit. When she died, I thought I had lost everything. But then I realized I still had the love I had given her. I don't even know if she was able to receive that love. She could not respond in any way. Her eyes were somber pools that reflected no light. But I was full of love, and that love keeps growing and multiplying and giving fruit. The pain of losing my child was a cleansing experience. I had to throw overboard all excess baggage and keep only what is essential. Because of Paula, I don't cling to anything anymore. Now I like to give much more than to receive. I'm happier when I love than when I am loved. I adore my husband, my son, my grandchildren, my mother, my dog, and frankly, I don't know if they even like me. But who cares? Loving them is my joy. Give, give, give. What is the point of having experience, knowledge, or talent if I don't give it away? Of having stories if I don't tell them to others? Of having wealth if I don't share it? I don't intend to be cremated with any of it. It is in giving that I connect with others, with the world, and with the divine. It is in giving that I feel the spirit of my daughter inside me like a soft presence.
That's New York Times best-selling author Isabel Allende. She recorded that essay in 2005 for the NPR series This I Believe. Just ahead, I talk with her ahead of her appearance tonight in Atlanta. This is On Second Thought.
Felt like the weight of the world was on my shoulders. Pressure to break or retreat at every turn.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. On tomorrow's show, we'll talk about how Southerners are portrayed on the silver screen. From Gone with the Wind to Walk the Line, what's your favorite film set in the South? Call and leave us a message at 404-500-9457. You can also post on Facebook and Twitter, of course, but be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. My next guest is New York Times bestselling novelist who's worked to bring many stories to life, especially those of her homeland. Chilean-American writer Isabel Allende has a new book called In the Midst of Winter. She speaks tonight at the Atlanta History Center. Good morning.
Good morning, Celeste.
I actually, if you don't mind, I'd like to start with a comment that Barack Obama made about your writing back in 2014. This is when he was awarding you the Presidential Medal of Freedom. And this is just a clip from his remarks at the ceremony.
When Isabel Allende learned that her grandfather in Chile was dying, she started writing him a letter. Night after night, she returned to it until she realized she was actually writing her first novel. She never really stopped. Her novels and memoirs tell of families, magic, romance, oppression, violence, redemption, all the big stuff. But in her hands, the big became graspable and familiar and human.
And I, the reason I wanted to start with that was because of that last thing he said, because this new novel to me is a perfect example of that. You've taken on some incredibly big topics, but you're telling them through a very small story. And I wonder why you chose the vehicle of what is essentially a murder mystery.
Well, the murder in the book is just an excuse to bring the characters together. It's a story of three unlikely characters that are brought together by a blizzard in New York last year in January. And the event that brings them together is a minor traffic accident that ends up being a murder story. But I didn't want the reader to think that they were reading a mystery novel. So the body really appears around page 100. By then, I hope that my readers will be familiar with the stories of each one of these three characters, and they will not be expecting a murder.
Yeah, and it's not a typical whodunit. There's no detective
searching
down clues, although we do not find out the real perpetrator until the end. But there's also this theme of the protections that we use. In other words, the three characters at the center of your novel have all been hurt in the past and have good reason to throw up walls and barriers, and that's what they seem to have done. How do you go about writing a character and making them lovable when they themselves are sort of protecting themselves from love in some ways?
Well, these three characters have been traumatized in the past, and they cope with their memories and with the trauma in different ways. The male character, Richard Beaumaster, is a man that has closed down, and his life is totally safe, and nothing can happen because he won't take any risks. He doesn't connect with anybody. He's very lonely. The character of the undocumented Guatemalan immigrant, the girl...
Evelyn, yeah.
Evelyn, she's... She's silent, mute, invisible. She lives in hiding. And then the character of Lucia, the Chilean writer who ends up lecturing in NYU for a year, so she's visiting, she has had very hard times too. But she's more feisty and she's a more open person. But she feels very lonely. The three characters are living in a sort of long emotional winter.
an emotional winter, but, you know, you're also talking, as the quote goes, about finding their own summer, and they find it in each other, that they begin to establish those emotional connections. Is there a deeper reason for that? And I bring that up because, you know, the United States at this point is having trouble connecting with itself, right? People,
because we don't listen to each other's stories. We think in numbers, we think in polls, we think in abstract. And the whole point of these three characters changing is because they sit down and they share their stories. And then when they know more about each other, Lucia and Richard are willing to take a huge risk to help Evelyn. And Evelyn finds, for the first time in a long time, she finds help and she finds solidarity, compassion, even humor. So the three of them in those 3 days of their adventure, they sort of find the invincible summer that we all have inside by sharing their own stories.
Do you find, have you seen examples of this occurring in real life? Because,
of course,
as a journalist, I'm pretty cynical about this. I see people yelling at each other and hating each other.
In modern America, we tend to be very polarized and separated. And we will not talk to people who don't think like us on both sides. Until we get to listen to the stories. You know, there's, for example, a theater company that works with people from Palestine and from Israel. And they, by working together, they listen to each other's stories and they begin to understand each other. If they can do it, we can too.
So tell me a little bit more about where this story comes from, do you think, in the context of your writing history? Because you're an incredibly successful novelist. Your books have been read by millions of people. Is this story the story of sort of your maturity as an author?
No, it's just a story that was in the air. I started writing this book on January 8th of last year, when Trump wasn't even a candidate. He wasn't in the picture until May. And so the story of immigration, of loneliness, of separation was already in the air. And I picked up what was there. And by the time the country became so divided after the election, the book was done. I think it was very timely, just by coincidence.
Well, since you've mentioned it, the Evelyn Ortega is the immigrant, undocumented immigrant from Guatemala, who's sort of is the catalyst for all that happens in some ways. And you brought up, you talked about the issue of immigration in your book, The House of Spirits, which was adapted into a 1993 film. And so let's hear a little clip of the film. Here we hear Antonio Banderas. He's trying to rally a group of workers, and then he's cut off by Esteban.
Jesus Christ was a revolutionary himself. We have a right to demand wages for our work. Revolutionary! Yes! God! We have a right to rest on Sundays! We have a right to vote! We have a right to...
Enough. Go back to work.
How do you, as a novelist, approach immigration, knowing that a good number of your readers are going to already have a formed opinion on that issue?
That's for me, the purpose of my writing is to bring people together. I have a foundation, and my foundation works with women and children in different areas. But in the last 3 years, we've been focusing a lot on refugees and immigrants, illegal immigrants, as they call them, although no one should be illegal in this planet. We all have the right to live here. So I know cases like the case of Evelyn Ortega very closely. I didn't have to make that up, unfortunately. I only had to research a bit about the gangs and about the political situation in Guatemala. But the rest, I had it. It's here. And when you start listening to the stories, it's very hard to close your heart. People who have an opinion about immigrants have never met one. Or if they have, they have never talked to one. They see it in terms of numbers, in abstract. And of course, if you think 11 million people that will be deported, that might make sense to some people until they hear the stories. No one leaves their country. Everything that is familiar to them, their home, their family, their language, and go to another place where they will be received with hostility, unless you are desperate. There were no Syrian refugees in Europe a few years ago. It's the situation in Syria that forced these people to get out and try to find a home somewhere else. So because I have been a political refugee and an immigrant, I know how it is and what it takes.
I'm speaking to New York Times bestselling author Isabel Allende. Her latest book is In the Midst of Winter. She speaks tonight at the Atlanta History Center. What is your writing routine? Do you write every day?
Not every day, because I don't have a book in process always. I usually start my books. I always start my books on January 8th. And then I don't finish it in a year. Usually it takes around 18 months. And then the rest of the time I have to be correcting, do the book tour, promotion, and researching for the next book. I have written 23 books in 35 years. So that's more or less 18 months per book.
What is the significance of January 8th?
Discipline. I needed it to start. Because I really do, Celeste, because my life is complicated.
Yeah.
I need to carve time, silence, solitude, so that I can write. And if I don't have a day to start, which everybody respects by now, I wouldn't be able to do it.
So are you one of the authors that hates book tours or enjoys them?
I hate the traveling, and I love being with my readers. Because the people who come to an event, they have read me, and that's why they're coming. So it's a very welcoming audience. Never in a book tour, in any event, have I met anybody who has been hostile or aggressive to me, ever. So I know it's a very selected audience and a captive audience, but still, it's very rewarding. I get a lot of energy and love, and that's wonderful.
How do you choose what to read in each different
place? I don't read. I just talk. Usually I'm in conversation with a journalist or another writer or someone. And then we open it to the audience, and the audience asks questions. So every event is different depending on the questions, which makes it much more interesting for me also.
But are there some questions you don't want to answer? Do you
no,
not?
There are no forbidden questions.
Even about personal life?
No, even about personal life. I can talk about everything. People ask me, I'm 75 years old, and now after divorcing my husband, we've been married for 28 years. I was alone for a while, and then I found another love at 75. So people keep asking me all kinds of indiscreet questions about falling in love at 75. I have no problem. Celeste, I have no problem talking about it.
Although
he might have problems, but not me.
But it must have given you some kind of realistic details, because that's what happens kind of with Lucia and Richard in your I think they're in their 60s.
I didn't meet him when I was writing this book. It was
what, really?
Yeah. I didn't know him when I was writing the book.
That is incredible.
And what is more incredible is that he was living like Richard. He's a widower, and after his beloved wife died, he just closed down. And he lived a life of routine, a very safe life in which nothing happened, good or bad. He was totally safe and totally asleep in life.
So you were writing your own love story.
Before it happened. It's very strange.
That is incredible.
Yeah, my mother says that I sort of invoked him.
you wrote him into being.
Exactly.
which kind of takes me back to some of your books do deal with sort of magical things that are beyond full explanation, the kind of intangibles you can't entirely explain. This one doesn't. This one is mostly grounded in reality. How come?
It is. The only element that could be considered a little magical is when Evelyn Ortega is taken by her grandmother to see a curandera, a shaman. And the curandera gives her to drink a tea, and the tea is ayahuasca. And so she has hallucinations. And the hallucinations seem magical because she has visions of the totemic animals. She has visions of the future and the past. But that happens with that drug. I have taken it a couple of times Once I took it because I was going to write a book placed in the Amazon, and this is the drug of the Amazon. So I was there and I took the drug. And really, it's an incredibly powerful trip that you never forget. So that's what, that happens to Evelyn, and that sort of explains the what she believes, her beliefs.
So how do you know when an idea is strong enough to become a novel?
When it feels in my womb, it feels in the belly, like a calling, I think about it. It becomes not exactly an obsession, but a recurrent thought, a recurrent dream. Then I know that something is happening inside me. Because people give me wonderful stories. I get letters all the time from readers that say, this is my story, but I can't write it. Can you tell it for me? I can't. Because the story needs to be connected to something that is important for me. I write about what I care for. And I choose the characters because they are going to speak for me. I don't write, for example, I have only written one crime novel, but I don't write thrillers or romance novels or those novels that are a formula, a genre that doesn't require you to be personally involved. All my stories have to do with something that I care for.
Although this novel is both a crime drama and a romance. It's just not told that way.
Yeah, but it's a novel of characters and personal stories.
So
the romance or the crime are not essential in the novel. It just brings people together.
So at this point in the year, as of November, this is when you're doing book tour-y stuff, which means you're probably going to start another book in a couple months.
I know. I'm panicking. Can you imagine? I start on January 8th. January 7th is a terrible day for me.
Do you already know what you're going to be writing about?
I sort of know. I have a vague idea, and I've been researching for months a time and a place. And that gives me enough material for the first breath of the novel. When I start the first few weeks, when I don't have a story, I don't have the characters, but I sort of have an idea of where it's going to happen and when.
Well, it's kind of cool that on January 8th, I'm gonna look up at some point and say, Isabel Allende has started
energy,
a novel.
Yeah, send me energy and angels to help me.
New York Times bestselling author Isabel Allende, her latest book is In the Midst of Winter. It is a beautiful novel. She speaks tonight at 7 o'clock at the Atlanta History Center. Such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Celeste.
And that's it for today's show, but we'd love to hear from you. What are you reading right now? If you have any good reading recommendations, book recommendations, we want to hear them, especially if they are good as gifts. Call and tell us at 404-500-9457 or find us on Twitter. It's at OST Talk. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.